This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Row One Seat One podcast. This is Ben, aka Boston Nuga. We are here with part two of the CWF retrospective here with Brad Stutz and Grant Sawyer. Thank you guys for listening to part one. I am here with Brad and Grant. Guys, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, buddy.
It seems like forever since I talked to you guys.
Right?
Yeah.
So much has happened.
Grant peed. That's basically what happened. But no, seriously. Thank you guys for coming on. This part of the show, we'll be talking about the worldwide era and the end.
That's not ominous or anything.
No. We'll get into as much of it as you guys want to get into. And we're going to keep this all positive as much as we can here. So let's talk about worldwide, because that's really where I got in. I will just say, from personal experience as a fan, CWF Worldwide was a hell of a show. It was must-watch television for me for a good period of time. You guys had some really compelling characters. You had some excellent wrestlers. You had some really wonderful storylines going on. It was just an enjoyable, digestible hour of television every single week. Well-produced, Grant, and well-written, Brad, and well-done, and well-done by the wrestlers as well. And something to be very proud of, boys.
We appreciate it. I mean, honestly, looking back at it, it's probably the most rewarding work I've ever done on a production level, like week in and week out for such a sustained length of time.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, like we touched on a little bit in part one, there had been a directive from Danny Winkle that he wanted CWF to become an internet darling. And to be clear, this is really that idea predates, PWG becoming a real powerhouse. Like, PWG was this thing people kind of knew about in California, but not really. Like, he wanted to be, you know, like a lot of promotions are now. He wanted to be the talk of the town on the internet.
And, you know, being in Los Angeles and stuff, that obviously gives PWG an advantage, just like a promotion would have the advantage running in the north. But I feel like we could have, if we had started earlier on with production and distribution and stuff like that and got our product out there, I think we could have been like that PWG level promotion.
Well, maybe. We were talking about the early days of Worldwide. We kind of glossed over the night that changed everything, and the moment that changed everything was CWF gets invited to the first National Pro Wrestling Day.
Oh, right.
That Chikara Pro put on back in 2013, I think it was. And we had done a couple of internet pay-per-views that, like, you know, double-digit people bought. Thank you, Sarah, in Australia, for buying the pay-per-views. We had done a couple of iPay-per-views that, you know, were very mildly received. And we get invited to National Pro Wrestling Day. Chikara, when they would come through, North Carolina would use our venue. Dragon Gate USA used our venue at least once that I recall. The match was Trevor Lee and Rick Converse against Eric Royal and Chiva Kidd, who had been a mask character this whole time. And I had no idea what they were going to do. But basically, they structured the match for Chiba Kid to be the breakout star. And then very shortly thereafter, he took the mask off and became and it launched Andrew Everett. But that's the moment that changed everything. That's the first time that CWF, maybe not literally, but for lack of a better term, trended.
I was in the audience and I was going through Twitter. And it was so shocking. I mean, I was literally in tears because of the reaction the crowd gave us, because it was such an uphill battle for us to get any form of recognition. And these people lost their minds for us, and I'm looking through the Twitter, and it's just like we had never gotten anything like that before.
Right, and we had always kind of felt like our stuff was good if people would ever see it. I remember around like 2012 or maybe even 2013, around this time, Jim Cornette does a shoot interview with Kayfabe Commentaries where he basically talks about the end of his run at Ring of Honor. And Cornette talks about how they didn't do anything that he said that they should do. And what he talks about is, he says, I told Ring of Honor they need to get a building that just holds like 300 or 400 people, have that be their wrestling school and their TV studio, keep all the, you know, have the stuff there to produce the TV show, and it's also the rest. And everything he's talking about is CWF. You know, it's OVW also. That's you know, where the model kind of originated in some way. Not originated, but I was just like, he's talking about this, and I'm just like, man, if we could just get these shows in front of some people, maybe something could happen for us. So National Pro Wrestling Day, you know, the CWF match stole the show that day. I think that's a commonly held opinion. I have heard reports that that was said in a locker room meeting. I wasn't there, but I've heard reports that it was. And I remember I just met Drew at the – I met Drew at the curtain, and I just hugged him real tight, and he go, and I was like, man. He's like, that was great. And he goes, I broke Trevor's fucking jaw. And I was like, did you? And he's like, on the moonsault, I broke his jaw. And I was like, well, damn. Still fucking great, though. But in a weird way – For the promotion at the time, that kind of helped, because in a weird way, because Drew became the star and Trevor was out for a little while, so we got to film some nice little promos of Trevor with his jaw, you know, wired shut, speaking through gritted teeth about how it should have been him. It helped. It was completely accidental, but it helped the story in a weird way.
I'll say Trevor was always going to be a star, but having his jaw broke and sitting out that amount of time drove him insane, and it lit a fire under him. He was ready. Yeah. He was off and running when he came back from that injury.
When he came back, he was ready to be a top guy at that point. And so we were very lucky. Like I talked about the Virginia boys on part one, we were very lucky that Trevor and Drew came along at about the right time. We always had a great relationship with Cedric Alexander, and I had access to Cedric Alexander, you know, pretty regularly. Manny Garcia, you know, early on, he kind of just missed the worldwide thing, but he went on to be No Way Jose. So, in other words, guys were starting to get out of the Carolinas, which had never happened before. Like Bret Attitude was signed to the WWE and went to FCW. But that was like when FCW was on one cable channel in Florida. It wasn't like going to NXT is now.
Yeah.
It was nothing like that. And frankly, not that they didn't earn it, but we have to thank Kevin Owens. From what I understand, Kevin Owens was the one who made the recommendation to PWG that they should book Drew, Trevor, and Cedric Alexander. That's what I was told at the time. I assume it to be true.
Cool.
So, and I only met Kevin Owens once, so I don't really have any kind of relationship with him to speak on. But
that was based on that one show he worked.
Right. Yeah. Okay. From what I understand, also where he had worked with him in Charlotte for PWX.
Okay.
If I remember the story correctly, from what I was told at the time, he was the one who put the word in for those three guys to get booked for PWG. So thanks, Kevin Owens. Rick Converse was a great talent. As a heel or a babyface, he always carried himself like the champion. He always looked great. Corey Edsel was a big bad motherfucker, and he had a great face, and he had big hands, and you know, there were guys that came along who were marketable, but there just wasn't a platform. Like I said, it wasn't like now where you can just share a clip. If Kamikaze, you know, I talked about Corey Edsel. If Kamikaze had come along now, he'd be going to GCW. He'd be, you know, like almost similar to like an Alex Zane.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't have a body like Alex Zane, but if Kamikaze came along now, he would be everywhere.
You know who Kamikaze is now? Darby Allin.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a better comparison. Yeah. Because he was just this little, you know, masked guy with some, you know, kind of shitty tattoos, and he didn't really have a look, but goddamn, he would fucking backflip off the roof and not care, you know what I mean? We went on after Kazi one night. He was in the semi-main, and we were in the main. I was managing Yamaha still, and we went on after Kazi, and I distinctly remember he was wrestling Lance Lude, and Kazi had an A finish and a B finish for that match, because it was like they had broke in together, and this was like their high profile, because CWF even back then was kind of a high profile place to work.
Yeah,
it was certainly better than working on little rec center shows in Virginia. And I was like, why do you have two finishes? And he goes, in case I knock myself out on the first one. if I knock myself out on the first one, we're going to do the, you know, we're going to do the second one. And I'll be damned if he didn't knock himself out and they did the B finish.
Jesus Christ.
Right. But he was, you know, fucking fearless. Absolutely. Or if he was scared, he hit it well. Lance Lude doing, you know, somersault sentons off the top of the cage onto the floor, just hoping that, you know, Jesse Ortega and two other guys will catch him, you know? Like, these guys, I wish there had been the platform like there is now on YouTube and on social media for those guys, but there just wasn't, you know? But yeah, there are. But anyway, we were fortunate that we had guys come along who were as marketable, if not more so, than those guys. They came along at a time when there was a platform to market them, because the point I'm getting at is the guys prior to them didn't have that platform.
Sure.
So that, you know, and there were some guys that came along, you know. Smith Garrett had a good run in the worldwide era. Jesse Adler, Chet Sterling. You know, Chet Sterling was going to be the guy. You know, I mean, I thought that was pretty clear from watching the shows. Mm-hmm. That this was the heir apparent. You know, and frankly, shout out to Nova Pro. Shout out to Nova Pro Mike and the whole crew up there. I mean, they put Eric Royal in the ring with Chris Hero. You know, they put him in the ring with you know, Dominic Dijakovic and Sanjay Dutt and all these, you know, great people. They put Chet Sterling in there with some good people. You know, that I think that helped in the worldwide era. You know, get not just the names of those couple of guys out, but get the name of CWF out.
And get their reps, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And also shout out to Omega, because Shane Helms and the Hardys were all in between contracts at the time. And these were more kind of shows for the community that drew real well. They're on High Spots, I think, but they relaunched Omega and ran, you know, six or seven shows where guys got to be around, you know, not just the Hardys and Helms, who are incredible, but, you know, Christopher Daniels was on those shows, Luke Gallows, you know, a really good group of people. So all of a sudden now the world is changing in the sense of it's easier than ever before to get your name out there and to share footage. And all these opportunities are popping up that have never really been there before. So timing had a lot to do with it. I think Worldwide had a role in that, obviously, but it also came along at the right time, too.
Grant, from a production standpoint, Worldwide was head and shoulders above stuff you even see today. What were you doing that was different? Were you making it up on the fly? Were you trained to do this sort of stuff? I mean, talk about what went into the production and what made it stand out.
Well, I've never been a tech guy, as weird as that sounds. Like, I can't really fix a computer. I don't know. Like, I'm working for the ACC network now, and I don't know what cameras I'm shooting on. I'm just shooting. I'm one of those guys that, like, it just feels right.
Sure.
You know, and, like, some people, you know, and I'm not trying to put myself over, but some people, like, just have the eye for what looks good. And it's just one of those things that I always sensed. I knew a lot of independent promotions, you know, with where they would position the ring, it would almost where they would position the camera in regards to the ring would almost devalue the look of their shows, because it was almost the same height as the ring. So, like, your backdrop was this giant empty space. While if you just did if you angled it up higher, you would be looking down and you would have more of a crowd. The only promotion that's ever like shot straight onto the ring is like WWE or WCW, because there's 10,000 people there. You can get away with it. You can't get away with that in an independent promotion. And most people just don't realize how much the visual presentation of your entire show can change with a simple adjustment of the camera. Aside from that, it's just of course we'll probably get into the pacing a lot too, but I just wanted everything to be, you know, as far as ring entrances and, you know, going from, you know, match to match, and for whether it's the live show or the TV, you just have to keep things moving.
I mean, you mentioned the pacing, and you mentioned keeping things moving. That was one of the hallmarks of the Worldwide Show, and has something to do with both of you guys on it. I think Grant has more to do with it than people give him credit for. It moved at a very brisk pace. It moved at a very digestible pace. Talk about how you kept the trains running.
Part of the timing thing came from probably my time in television, because if you're in black in television, it's an eternity. People are screaming at you. If you're in black for 30 seconds, you know, you're maybe getting fired. And I wanted to take that same approach as far as wrestling shows. There was just too much dead time, too much music playing with nothing else going on.
Nothing used to make me happier than when someone would show up to the CWF building with their nice custom ring music that had, you know, the first minute and a half of Kryptonite by Three Doors Down, and then I come out at this point, and Grant would chop that shit down to 8 seconds every single time. But you know what? It was fair, because he would have done it to anybody. You know, he absolutely would have. It was no long, you know, and to the point now where honestly I have no patience for that stuff on an indie show. If there's too much talking, if there's too much dead air, if there's ring intros are too long. Another thing that really helped us out, and I learned this at Nova Pro when I tried to help the boy time out Nova Pro shows, another thing that helped us out was the ramp was right there and the ring was right there. So there wasn't a whole lot of space in the room to walk around and high five everyone. Like, we told people not to do that anyway, you know, just go to the ring, don't, you know. But even if they wanted to, it didn't take more than 30 seconds or so to get around the ring there. Whereas like a big room like Nova Pro ran, you had to allow for that time, because you literally could not get to the ring as fast as you could at CWF. So I that's something I learned later on the fly. But we really benefited from, you came right out of the curtain and you're right there at the ring and you go right in. And if you got your pose or whatever, you can hit it right there. That helped as much as anything with killing the downtime in between matches or downtime in between entrances. And honestly, we were met with – if you ask me who at CWF had the biggest ego, I honestly couldn't tell you, because we were met with so little ego from people. Everybody got it. And everybody, for the most part, got that it wasn't anything personal. Like I said, CWF was like a commune. It was for the greater good. You know, it's not that your minute and a half intro that you do everywhere else isn't good or whatever, but I'm not going to let them do it, so I can't let you do it either. If we had booked David Starr, David Starr would not have done his fucking 2 minute entrance where they read off the names or whatever. I don't think. Maybe. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Maybe that's a bad example, but you know, it was, like I said, people got that it wasn't anything personal. It was in the interest of the greater good. There was a utilitarianism to everything me and Grant tried to do as far as keeping the show moving, you know, running a tight 7:30 to 10 o'clock until Trevor started wrestling for an hour every week. That became its own thing. Prior to that, if they were still in the ring at 10:05, Grant would have turned the lights on. I firmly believe this.
I have been in an indie show before, not CWF, where that show went so long, I think it was during the semi-main, I just got off the apron, packed my stuff, and went home.
Yeah.
Like, I was done. Like, your show went too long, and I left.
I'm a big believer in, like, 7:30 to 10, you know, in that, maybe even 2. If you get it down to 2 hours, that's even better. But we had a lot of guys to work with, and we had to get 2 hours of TV out of it. So, you know, 7:30 to 10 Eastern became our calling card. But then Trevor started having those long matches, and that became the ticket seller, and then that becomes different. Then people aren't mad that they're there at 10:30. They're happy that they're at 10:30 then. So that becomes a little different.
And then we still structured the undercard right. to accommodate that as well.
Right. But yeah, it was, and I've had a lot of guys tell me that they learned how to work, that CWF was the only place that ever taught them how to work TV style, you know, as opposed to you know, an indie show where you might have 20 minutes or whatever. If you had 20 minutes at CWF, you were in one of the matches that we thought was really, you know, pivotal, that was a ticket selling match or that had a backstory or something like that. Everything else was just, you know, it was a tight TV match, give us your best stuff. And people, we were blessed to have I haven't talked enough about how great the crew we had at CWF was, but we were blessed to have a crew who, by and large, when I said, just give me 5 minutes of your best stuff, they were smart enough to know that I meant 5 minutes of your best stuff that fits in the context of being in the second match, not 5 minutes of the most spectacular moves that you can do. By and large, almost to a person, well, as far as people that stuck around for any length of time, to a person, everyone became familiar with the concept of working your place on the card. And the show does not succeed without that. If everyone just goes out there and does whatever the hell they want, then the show does not succeed the way that we envision the show going. You know what I mean? And I saw that happen on other shows, and management did not feel empowered to discipline the guys or yell at them for going too long or whatever. And it sets a bad precedent. I think, again, I haven't talked to many people in the past couple years. I'm sure we'll get into that. But I would like to think that one of the things that people could agree upon about the way me and Grant ran the shows is, at the very least, it was pretty fair. You know, it wasn't like I was only letting you go 3 minutes every time, you know? Maybe some people feel that way, but I would like to think they would not.
Going back to what you were saying about learning how to work TV, and you mentioned this to me on more than one occasion, specifically like for the Rumble, for example, we would ask so much more of our crew than what even WWE would ask because of the beats they would have to hit on every show, but in that specific match. And you said, as far as learning how to work TV, we were actually making it – it was more difficult working for our production sometimes than it would be in them because of the specific times that, like, I was putting them under.
Right, and please nobody go on Twitter and say, Tutsi said the CWF Rumble was better than WWF. That's not what
I
mean.
No, not at all.
But, you know, if you watch the Rumble, there's a lot of guys who are just in there for, like, 18 minutes and then they get eliminated and that's it.
And the clock is worked.
Right, and we never did that. Everybody had a – when we did that 30-man Rumble every October, everybody had some purpose. There was some, you know, even the guys that did the little in and out in 2 seconds or whatever that, you know, we didn't have a ton of, everybody had some utilitarian purpose in the match, you know, and they're worn out there just killing time. I think that's one of the big takeaways of Worldwide is we tried to make everything mean something. Every minute means something. Every match means something.
And I'm so incredibly grateful for that crew for, like, getting, like you said, they always got it, they understood, and it was like, it was never an issue. You know, maybe there was a little slip up here or there on a time thing, but there was nothing ever egregious.
The proudest I ever was, as someone who runs shows, a booker, whatever you want to call me, was, I believe it was the anniversary show where Trevor wrestled Brad Attitude in the main event. The semi-main event, if I have my shows correctly, was Andrew Everett against Eric Royal. And on the anniversary show every December, we would usually do more matches. We would usually do 3 hours instead of 2.5. It was a, you know, it was a show kind of feel. And that night we did 10 matches, and no one did a dive until Drew did one in match 9 of 10. And it wasn't like they had to be told. They just knew. That wasn't Drew's spot. Yeah, it wasn't even that much that it was necessarily Drew's spot. They knew it wasn't their spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they knew that this match didn't need a dive. You know what I mean? And like, I go to some indie shows and people will be like, oh, you got to watch such and such show. And I'm just pulling my hair out. Even WWE. WWE, you watch a pay-per-view, and they've got guys bumping on the apron on the kickoff match. And I don't understand that. I don't, if that's where the business is headed, I don't understand that. But we fought hard to make sure that when we had some hot opening matches, but that by and large, people knew what the purpose of their match was. That was the thing that I drilled home more than was this is the business of this match. This is the purpose of it. I heard Terry Taylor say one time that he got it from Kevin Sullivan, who I would assume got it from Eddie Graham. But and it always stuck with me. It was don't book the match unless you can book how the match should go, how the finish should go, and what's the return. What's the thing you're trying to get out of it? The return is not necessarily me against you again in 2 weeks. The return might be I go up strong on you so that 2 weeks from now when I wrestle him, I'm in a better position. You know what I mean? And so that's how I always try to look at things. What's the purpose of this? What does the match look and feel like? And what does the finish look and feel like? And like I said, the crew that we had during the Worldwide era, I'm positive is my favorite crew that I'll ever work with. I have no doubt about that because by and large, like I said, to a man, they got it. And there was very little ego and there was very little bitching. And it really did by and large feel like a team effort.
So you guys are starting to get some internet buzz, 2015, 2016, 2017. Did it change anything about the locker room and or especially management?
No.
Not really.
Okay.
Not that I recall. There would always be some people who kind of seemed opposed to quote unquote outsiders coming in and
catering to the internet crowd.
Yeah. And I liked that. I said multiple times in meetings, that I, you know, we had a car from Freelance come up one time. We had cars from Nova Pro, cars from Chikara, Florida, you know, Indiana several times. And I would always say in the pre-show meetings that it humbled me and it just made me, it reaffirmed that we were doing something right, that this carload of people wanted to come from Indiana and be away from their girlfriends or their brothers or their sisters or their jobs or whatever. It meant enough to them to come and work here on a shoestring budget. I mean, on no budget. It meant enough for them to come here and be 4, 5, 6 in a car for 8, 9, 10 hours at a clip. That meant a lot to me. And I wanted to, it wasn't like I necessarily, it wasn't like I put belts on those guys or anything like that, but I wanted them to get an experience that was worth it for them. And I think on some level with certain people, there was always maybe an undercurrent that I didn't appreciate the local guys enough. Because, if you weigh it, it does carry a lot of weight that somebody is willing to drive 11 hours to come wrestle for your promotion. And maybe there was the notion, this was never explicitly stated to me, but maybe there was the notion that I didn't have enough regard for the people that drove 40 minutes.
But at the same time, I cannot remember a single scenario where I ever felt we shafted somebody locally for those guys.
Right. And I mean, other than maybe like a trainee that just came with somebody who I threw on in like a 6-man or something, I never booked anybody who I thought would appeal only to the internet people. I thought, the internet, quote unquote, speaking of the internet like it's one governing body, yes, or whatever, the internet, quote unquote, knows the carnies. But I have complete confidence in the carny's ability to get over in this room. It wasn't like I ever sacrificed the enjoyment of the people in that room who had to endure this goofy internet wrestler, if that makes sense.
Well, I think even someone like, he's a local guy, but someone like Dirty Daddy got over in two different ways. He got over just, with his work and charisma to the local crowd, but those preposterous promos he was getting over on the internet. He got over, I mean, right. credit to him for getting over in completely separate fashions to both audiences.
That's a great point, because we used to talk about, if you just come to the shows, you probably don't even get what Dirty Daddy's gimmick is. But he would do those promos talking about wrestling in Memphis and all, you know, and you're right, it worked on two levels. I tried to do stuff like that. I tried to do stuff that would work on both levels, and I tried to get people who I thought would appease both masters, so to speak.
I had the joy of attending, was it 2016 or 2017, the CWF FanCon? Was it 16 or 17?
17, wasn't it?
Was it 17?
That Rumble weekend, right?
Yeah, that 17. Rumble weekend. Was 17?
It would have to be.
Yeah, it had to be. It's the the Rumble Trevor one, right?
Yeah, the Rumble Trevor one, yeah. Yeah, it was 17?
Yeah,
that's 17. Yeah. My dates, you could tell me something happened in 2004 or 2017. I'd tell you, sure, why not? I know JB and Johnny helped set up a CWF fan con. I came out with Josh from Alabama, Pete from Texas. We had an absolutely wonderful love fest. You guys helped set up a viewing of some matches. The wrestlers were all very accommodating. Trevor won the Rumble. Just an absolutely wonderful time. Talk about what
that was. I'm sorry. I was going to say that's the peak of my independent wrestling life that weekend.
Yes, one of my peaks as well. It was a total love fest. I just described it as a love fest. It really, yes. really was. Talk about what went into that. You mentioned it as the peak of your wrestling life. Why was it such?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, it felt like we finally arrived. All you guys were coming from other areas to watch our stuff. You know, you came all that way because you believed in what we were doing. I mean, that's the greatest. That means far more than any money or anything else. I mean, that's like we did it. Like, you know, we became that internet darling in that window of time, and then we capped it off with that show. And you know, that Rumble, it was. I mean, God bless Trevor Lee, but you know, it was immaculate. You know, I can't praise him enough for carrying out our vision for that night. And like, I mean, I know like. Me and Kane Justice after that match, you know, I mean, we were both in tears and hugged, and it was a wonderful little emotional scene behind the curtain there. It was everything about that weekend was just so perfect, and Love Fest is the perfect descriptor for it.
Brad?
I think the peak for me was the tag tournament.
Which would be probably number two.
In like March of 17, and that's also the night of the Trevor Lee Chip Day match. That was the peak for me, but you know, I'm a big Hunter S. Thompson fan, and you know, he talks about with the right kind of eyes, you can see the high water mark where the wave broke. And for me, I always think about that when I think about that weekend, because that's the high water mark.
And for the Rumble, I knew when that match ended and we went to black, I knew it would never be that high again. And I'm not saying that with 2020 hindsight. I thought it that night that we would never reach that pinnacle again. And for you, it was the tag tournament.
For me, it was the tag tournament, but also like the Trevor Lee Chip Day match. I was only there, what is that, 6 or 7 months more after that. But that kind of, in a way, that kind of became an albatross around my neck, me personally, because I had a lot of anxiety about the shows and stuff that I never really got to talk to anybody about. I talked to Grant about it some, but you know, if a house was down, I felt like I'd let the whole team down. What did I do? What did I fail to do? What failed to connect? You know, and houses are going to be down. You know, but so that you know, Trevor and Chip have that great match, and it's kind of the talk of the town for a little while. But then after that, when that didn't really move the dial any tangible way. Like, it wasn't like we got hundreds of new subscribers or dozens and dozens of new followers. You know, everyone was kind of like, you should go check out this match. And a lot of people did. But when that didn't really move the dial in any tangible way, that was when I was like, well, what else can we do? You know, and it really weighed on me. And I, like I said, that's the high watermark for me. That's probably my favorite match I ever called. And I love both those guys as people and as wrestlers. But when that match failed to really move the dial, or at least move the dial in any way that registered with me, that was really kind of the beginning of the end for me. Because that was when it was like, well, what else can we do? Like, what else? We had this perfect, you know, microcosm where we had this tag tournament where all these teams, the Dirty Blondes were in that tag tournament. You know, there was a team from Indiana. There was all these, you know, Carnies came. There was all this, you know, eyeballs. We had, you know, Stokely Hathaway against White Mike that on that card. Like, you know, but then when that match hit, and it was as good, and everybody said it was as good as, you know,
great.
They
was.
Huh?
It was great.
Yeah, when that match hit and everybody said it's as good as they said it was, but then it didn't really move the dial for the company, I became very frustrated because I was like, there's no way. Like, what do you have to do? And kind of seeing the way things have gone in the past couple of years across independent wrestling in general, I became even more frustrated and even more disheartened because it kind of seems like the only thing you can do to move the dial is to fucking, you know, flip pile drive Marco off the stage and break his leg. You know, like, I don't know. But that's the high watermark for me, but it also became a point of a lot of frustration and anxiety for me because I didn't know what else we could possibly do to grow the audience in a tangible way.
So, we'll kind of cut to it a little bit because it's kind of a good touching point. Brad, you lasted about another, and Grant, you as well, you said about another 6 or 7 months in the promotion?
Yeah. My last show was the anniversary show in 2017. And before the first official show in 2018, I was relieved of my duties.
And I left. Well, my last show would have been that first RGL show this start of 2018, and I mean, I guess technically I took a leave of absence. I didn't quit, but yeah, here I am.
You're like Cosmo Kramer, you're just on strike.
Right.
you've just been on strike for 15 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to say whatever you want to say about what happened, or?
Sure. In my mind, I was trying to build a network. And I was trying to build maybe even an empire, if it could be that. You know, I wanted to have CWF and Nova Pro and Modern Vintage and maybe PWX if they wanted to be a part of it. You know, I wanted to have a network where, you know, our guys could go get booked, get paydays, where something was happening every weekend for anyone who wanted to put that much into it and be somewhere every weekend, myself included. We haven't talked at all about Pro Wrestling International,
okay,
because Pro Wrestling International was kind of a quote-unquote governing body for CWF that existed mostly in abstract ideas. But, like, it got talked about enough that, like, to me, I thought that was one of the goals that we wanted, was to build a network. So what I was trying to do in real life was what the idea of PWI was set up to be, where we'd have a relationship with, you know, Nova Pro and Modern Vintage, and we would have had a relationship, I feel, with Southern Underground Pro and you know, going to Scenic City. I'm branching out with the intent of the company branching out with me. You know, I'm trying to build a network so that our guys can be in the Scenic City tournament, or Eric Royal might get the chance to wrestle Chris Hero at Nova Pro. You know, these are the things that I'm thinking about. Someone comes along who I think Jeff in particular thought was trying to infringe upon their territory. I didn't see it that way. I saw it as if Modern Vintage is going to run on the 22nd and CWF is going to run on the 1st and the 15th, I didn't see that as a problem. I didn't see that as a conflict of interest for me to book for both groups, for Grant to film for both groups, for talent to work for both groups and get another payday. I didn't see that as a conflict of interest. They did, apparently. And there were some things that they thought were questionable. I had no knowledge of any questionable activity, illegal activity. To my knowledge, none of that ever crossed my desk, as it were. They didn't see it that way. They felt it was a conflict of interest. They felt like my conduct had become questionable. I don't know if that's a byproduct of, like I talked about last time, about the PC culture. I don't know if that's a byproduct of that, because, you know, I can be honest enough about myself to say that maybe there were some times that my conduct was poor. But at the same time, that never seemed to be an issue until I fell out of favor politically. So, you know, when we had the conversation, it was pretty abrupt. There wasn't a lot of back and forth. They had made their decision. And quite frankly, I respect that decision. Because at the end of the day, whether you think I'm involved in something unseemly or not, like we touched on previously, Danny Winkle paid the bills at CWF. I did not. My name has never been on one lease of a building. I never once paid the light bill there. So at the end of the day, they could have just come and said, hey, we're replacing you. They didn't owe me the chance to book at CWF. So I thanked them for the opportunity and I went home. The internet, again, speaking about the internet like it's one big thing, talked a lot about things that are not true, that are not substantiated. There was never, to my knowledge, a complaint about me brought upon by anyone, male, female, animal, vegetable, or mineral. Again, if that happened, that information was never shared with me. And I am not now, nor have I ever been involved in any type of illegal activity. That's a baseless rumor. That's baseless speculation. I would challenge anyone to bring forth evidence that implicates me in any of that. And for that matter, the person that I was associated with at the time, to my knowledge, is not involved in any such activity, or was not at the time that I was associated with him. That's the only time that I can speak of. You know, I enjoyed my time. You know, like I said, I was trying to build a network where, you know, and I was, and that network, quite frankly, was successful. You know, Nick Richards got to wrestle Tommy Dreamer. That was his dream match. I wanted to make that happen for him, you know? But I guess it has, you know, piecing things together, people felt like that was a conflict of interest. The Katie Vick is alive show, I think, said it best. At the very least, it had become distracting. And they felt I needed to be removed from the position that I was in. And, hey, that's their prerogative. I harbor no ill will towards anyone who was responsible for that decision. That's their prerogative. You know, at the end of the day, I was playing in their sandbox. So, like I said, my name was never on the lease to a building. My name was never – I never paid the light bill there. So, that's that really. But they felt like I was becoming unseemly and that it was affecting the company negatively and, relieved me of my duties. I thanked them for the opportunity and I went home.
Grant, what are your thoughts?
Well, I guess.
Cause you know, left around the same time. So you clearly had some opinions.
There will be people that listen to this that obviously think everything Stutzy just said is BS or whatever. I can't help that. I know that I am very big on family and I'm very big on telling the truth. And I have to get up every morning and look in the mirror, my wife and my kid. And if I thought Stutzy was lying to me, I wouldn't be sitting here right now. I mean, that's as simple as, but not just to me, but lying about the situation in general. You know, the internet exaggerates a lot. It's very unfortunate. You know, when all went down, I wasn't sure exactly what my course of action would be, but it was, let's be clear, going back 2 years at least prior to Stutzy being fired, I had told him multiple times that if you leave, I am out of here as well, because I was so beyond burned out. Because even aside from Worldwide, I mean, this is a two-man project as far as, like, the production of it. It's me and Stutzy. And I was so burned out because it's not only – now, don't get me wrong. I loved doing Worldwide. But at the same time, they would run, like, RGL shows on 2 days' notice sometimes.
RGL is the student shows.
Sure, sorry, yeah.
The people that are currently training at the school, and they would run these shows where in their minds they weren't really debuting yet – but Grant always had the strong opinion that if it happens in that building and it happens in front of the same people, it happens in our universe.
Yes, it's canon.
You can't re-debut them on the main shows later.
Right. So they would have these, even aside from the TV tapings, they would have these Rising Generation League shows that I would, again, you know, shoot, edit, you know, release, or, you know, at least have a private link just so the boys could watch if we weren't releasing them publicly. And it was... So, I mean, I think at one point we ran like 6 or 7 straight weeks. And it's not like, I mean, I have all the respect in the world for obviously the guys busting their ass and, you know, in the ring and stuff. But, you know, it's not just a Saturday event for me and Stutzy. You know, on Saturday, like, I'm literally the first one at the building, one of the last ones to leave. Sunday, I'm kind of editing all day. And then whatever editing I have to finish up for Monday, and like, it was such a production, and I was beyond burned out. And this is not with any hindsight. I'm not saying this after the fact. I specifically told Stutzy, I am so done because if you go, because I cannot go back to the booking the way it used to be, because me and him, you know, we had just streamlined how we did things. I knew if I ever lost him as a booker, I wouldn't have that same back and forth with anyone else. So even if he had left on a good note, let's be clear about this, I was still probably gone. I just needed a break. And then, you know, I had emailed Jeff and Danny. You know, I was very undecided, you know, after everything went down. I just told him I needed some time off. And, you know, I just let me think, you know, I'm not saying I'm done or anything, you know, but like, just give me, and then, you know, as it played out, some things occurred in my absence that made it very easy not to go back. And the way certain things were promoted and handled and things that were said, and, you know, there were some people that obviously made it very public on the internet, and, you know, in any interviews they did, that they were very happy, I guess, to say that Stutzy was gone. And I think a lot of people lost sight of how much he tried to do to help their professional career, and in the end, how just unappreciated it was. And that really set the wrong way with me. And then, and I'm not saying that across the 95% of the locker room, I still have nothing but affection for. But, you know, sometimes it's easier to focus more on the bad than it is the good. Unfortunately, in life, that's the way it is. And, you know, the internet is certainly, you know, an aspect of that. And as time went on and things were promoted and handled in certain ways, it made it very easy for me to step away and not return.
So you guys both parted ways. CWF kept going, keeping the belt on Trevor Lee in perpetuity. I guess this is a good point to talk about, I guess, the backlash a little bit. Were you guys surprised at some of the backlash? Were you pleasantly surprised at some of the people who had your back? Or was it pretty much what you expected?
I know for me personally, I was so incredibly grateful for anyone that came to me, you know, privately or in DMs or even just publicly on Twitter and showed their appreciation for what we had done. That meant the world, and I will never forget, you know, the people that made the effort to do that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I felt an overwhelming sense of guilt and sadness that whether there was, you know, like I said, there wasn't illegal activity, it was nothing like that, but that me being a bonehead and getting in trouble had taken this thing away from so many people who loved it, you know? And I still do. If I talk to some of those people now and they kind of express, you know, how their fandom, their personal, the way that they personally enjoy wrestling took a downturn after that, I feel terrible.
I feel like we've seen a lot of things on Twitter over the past couple of weeks, you know, in memoriam, basically, of CWF. And it's a little strange for me. I don't know if you feel the same way. It's like we kind of went through this the multiple stages of going through a funeral like 2 years ago, and all these people are now going through what we went through. It's weird that there's this giant time gap of range of emotions that we're going through at two separate times in our lives.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a fair statement. But yeah, obviously, I think I've told the people that have given me their support or lended me their support privately, how much I appreciate them. Especially, it was very eye-opening to me who has your back when you can no longer do anything for them. And I don't say that casting any judgment on the people themselves. That's the nature of the business. That's the nature of any business. Business is cold. Business is, you know, marriages of convenience. And so that was very eye-opening to me because if you had asked me, you know, I would have assumed that my relationships with more people were genuine than they were. So that was very eye-opening in a sense of like, no, like, this, you know, it was almost like if you're stationed with somebody or like if you leave, or like literally if you leave a job, you know, you never see that person again. You know what I mean? So that was very eye-opening to me. Like I said, I carried around and do a lot of guilt that this thing that so many people loved, you know, kind of got a bomb dropped on it. But in a lot of instances, you know, in a lot of respects, you know, frankly, that's life. Like, nothing lasts forever. I am glad that we all had that time and enjoyed it. And I think for the most part enjoyed it at the time. I don't think we took it for granted. But, yeah, it was very, very interesting in the immediate aftermath and just some of the – even just some of the decisions that were made by the people still there and things of that nature, but that's their prerogative.
Did you guys ever try to watch CWF after you both left?
Very, very minimally. I tried a couple times to watch, you know, some people that I was tight with, their matches, just to kind of give them some critiques and stuff, as I typically would. I'm not trying to take shots. I mean,
no, it was bad. It was bad. I'll just say it.
Go ahead and say it again.
I'll say it. It was bad.
Well, you know, from a production standpoint, it was difficult to watch. And again, that's not a knock on anybody. You know, I'm not. But I attempted, the first time I attempted to watch, I believe it was the Trevor Roy Twitch stream, which I think when I tuned in, I had audio but no picture. And then I got booted out like 3 times. And then I saw like a stationary camera, like the wide shot was on for like forever, and I was like, kind of, nah, I can't watch this. And then I tuned back in for the Rumble that Aaron Biggs won to specifically watch how they laid out the Rumble. And that was – and Trevor's farewell speech. I did watch Trevor's farewell speech.
One last thing I want to touch on because you mentioned him. It seemed like the promotion lasted basically through Trevor and then a couple shows after Trevor. And we didn't really talk much about Trevor Lee. Talk about the importance of Trevor Lee in CWF Mid-Atlantic.
I mean, he was the man. I mean, like he worldwide would have obviously existed without Trevor. But, I mean, he's really the one, starting, I'd say, even with that hour 40-minute match against Roy Wilkins, that really kind of put worldwide on the map initially. Yeah, I mean, Trevor's the man. Like, he's awesome.
Yeah, super smart at you know, putting things together and structure and it's weird because I don't know if this, but at least I was sort of brought into the business and trained and conditioned that nobody's bigger than the promotion, nobody's bigger than the show. And so that was my mentality, but then, like, I had never seen a situation, you know, where somebody could be going on to bigger and better places, but he would rather stay in this place. You ever see a movie called Almost Famous?
Loved it.
It's an
amazing movie.
What's that?
Amazing movie.
Yeah, it's one of my. It's probably my favorite movie of all time. And there's kind of an undercurrent in that movie of that the guitar player could go on to do bigger and better things, but he stays with the band. And that always kind of reminded me of Trevor Lee, that he wanted to hold on to this thing and keep this thing together for as long as he possibly could. Don't read that as like, oh, he turned down WWE or nothing like that. But he wanted to be here as long as he could, and he wanted to make the most of it. And Trevor would give these speeches about how much he loved this place and about how when everything else is gone, we've still got this place. And I mean, the boys would have ran through a fucking wall after that speech. He meant it. It was real for him. It was the, you know, the place that he wanted to put on the map and would do everything he can for. So yeah, it is interesting. Like I said, I always think of Almost Famous, and I always think of, like, you know, no one's bigger than the promotion. But then we kind of had a situation where somebody kind of was. And that's not a knock on the promotion. It's just, you know, it would be like if Johnny Gargano kept going back to AEW, you know. And from what I understand, the two situations are very similar. But, you know, it would be like if Johnny Gargano was on NXT, you know, wrestling Tommaso Ciampa, but then next Saturday he's going to go wrestle at AIW. It was that kind of a thing where it's like, you know, this guy, you know, doesn't really need to be here. He wants to be here.
Sure.
He cares about it that much. It was very genuine. It was very emotional. It was very real.
So Trevor signs with WWE. They squeeze a few more matches out of him. And then got within, what, 3, 4, 5, 6 months, the promotion folds. Were you surprised in any way, shape, or form that the promotion folded, or did it seem like something running its natural course?
Well, they had officially folded as of this recording.
Okay, well,
you know, they put the statement up saying that they're taking things in a new direction. I haven't talked to anyone, so I don't really know what that entails.
Took a hiatus.
I'm sorry?
Took a hiatus, let's say that.
Right. I assume that means the era of producing weekly shows in one location is over, and that they are going to attempt to run shows, you know, on a lighter schedule, more sporadically. I don't know what that means.
Sure.
But to be clear, as of this recording, the promotion has not folded officially.
Okay, sure.
But to back up what you said, everyone sure reacted to that statement like it was the closing, including wrestlers there. It's certainly the closing on a chapter in time. you know, maybe I'm naive, but I kind of am surprised because I kind of just thought it would go forever. I kind of just thought if what had happened with me hadn't happened, I would be there forever. And in a way, I kind of just thought it would always soldier on in some way.
What year did I say we were closing down?
2015.
Yeah, we were closing in 2015 was my prediction.
Really?
Which, ironically enough, yeah. Because, well, I, you know, just knowing what the lease on the building was, and I, you
not
know.
Not that we weren't drawing or anything like that.
Right,
don't
no.
take it like that.
No, yeah. No, this is just my, you know, wacky opinions that I have. But I felt it, the future of the promotion always hinged more than anything else, Danny's desire to keep it alive. Danny Winkle is, you know, a wonderful human being, and I felt like once he reached his burnout point, that would start the end of CWF. You know, obviously it went far past my original prediction date, and, you know, I think a lot of that can be credited to him.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a heavy thought. I hate it for some of the guys who may struggle to find a home base because, frankly, there's not a ton of places where you can get your reps in the same place, you know, the same crowd. And there's, you know, those guys now are put in the position where they're going to have to they're going to have to find new places to work regularly, or they're going to have to find a lot of places to fill up the same amount of dates that they got from this one place for all those years. So I do kind of hate it for them.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, you know, very emotional, you know, Facebook posts or videos and stuff like, and some of the guys I don't even know, never really worked with, but I do feel I have sympathy for anyone that lost something they loved that didn't deserve to lose something, you know. But I mean, you know, that is life. You know, places open and close all the time. And I do hope those guys continue forward. But at the same time, I think it's probably realistic to say that whatever that final CWF show is will also be some guys' final matches. You know, because that's they may not be motivated enough to seek out other places to work.
There's sure. definitely a lot of guys who identify themselves as someone who wrestles for CWF more so than identifying themselves as someone who wrestles.
Sure.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, they have their own guys, definitely.
Yeah, but it really speaks to the culture that was created there, and that guys felt like it was their home and it was their family, and you know, That's a tough adjustment. You know, Grant talked about it a little while ago as far as us having already gone through it. That's the tough adjustment to all of a sudden not seeing those people every week.
The biggest thing I had trouble with once I left was I love on Wednesday getting all those tweets putting us over. I retweeted everything under the sun. It was very... I mean, you know, I think all of us in wrestling, and maybe as human beings, we're all a little bit of egomaniacs. And the biggest thing I had trouble with after walking away was feeling relevant. Like, I wanted so badly to do that SCI after everything happened because I needed that to feel still relevant in the industry. You know, I've been lucky enough to pick up, you know, some, you know, shooting gigs with ACC Network and not ACC Network and what to kind of fill that void in my life as far as like live production and being a part of something. But like, I mean, nothing's ever going to replace that worldwide era, you know, that week in, week out live production feel.
It's a high watermark.
It is.
So when you guys look back on CWF, is it generally positive or did the end kind of sour it?
Well, I think it's kind of like the whole relationship thing. Everyone, you know, it's hard not to focus on the end. Even if I told this to someone the other day, if you're in a marriage for 18 years and it ends in divorce, was your marriage really a failure? You were in it for 18 years, you know? Like, maybe it didn't end the way you wanted it to be, but there were good years in there, and that's a long freaking run. You know, like, it's so hard as human beings not to focus on how something ends, but it doesn't take away the wonderful times you had there. I think about, we haven't even touched about it, but the old post-show parties that we would have at my old house and stuff like that. I mean, stuff, those are the memories you carry with you forever. And, you know, and obviously the friendships you make that you retain after everything falls apart. Like, that's what you live with for the rest of your life.
Brad?
I look at it like a positive. You know, that was the end of my time there was a very traumatic event in my life, and made me question a lot of things and if I needed to change a lot of things in my life, which I have, and it made me a lot more aware of maybe my conduct, maybe how I'm perceived. But no, I look at it as a positive experience. I met, I had the best times of my life with those people at that place, or at Grant's house, or, you know, wherever, or with that, in that, community, you know, in that microcosm. I had the best times of my life. I met my wife. I met the people that I'm closest to in the world, either at that place or through my association with that place. You know, and I just think about, and even that night that everything went down, I said, you know, I have been so blessed to get this opportunity, you know. But you take money out of the equation and take, you know, anything else like that. Just how many people would love to get the chance to book a territory, to have weekly shows, you know, that you're kind of in charge of and you're, you know, responsible for, and you get to kind of call the shots on. You know, there's so many people who that would be their life's dream, and that was my life's dream. And I got to do it, and people liked it, and it meant enough to some people, you know, to come in from out of state to support it, or to do podcasts about it, or to celebrate its triumphs or mourn its failures. Nothing could ever not make that not touch me deeply, and it does, and I think it should for everyone who got to be involved in it. It was a blessing to get to do it. It was not, you know, wrestling doesn't owe anybody anything, so the fact that we got to do it is something we're celebrating. And like I said earlier, I don't walk around with bad feelings towards people. I don't walk around saying, oh, I got a raw deal, you know, because at the end of the day, I'm responsible for my own actions. And if there had not been enough things that were unseemly or that were questionable going on, then there would have been nothing. There would have been no reason for that to happen. You know what I'm saying? So I don't walk around with bad feelings towards anybody. I hate that place is in its current form not going to be there, you know, providing a place for people to get their reps in weekly. And yeah, I think it's I think it was one of the best times, probably some of the best times I'll ever have.
Cool.
So I look at it as a positive, almost completely.
Well, that's a great place to leave it off. Do you guys have any plugs?
Yeah, I'm with, I do commentary with AML Wrestling right now, at AML Wrestling on Twitter. They're also, on the High Spots Network, the AML Wrestling Network. It's all kind of, but they stream. It's very, it's kind of like CWF in some ways. It's good guys and bad guys, and it's traditional wrestling, and it's not what we might call, you know, the super indie style. So I feel very fortunate that they gave me an opportunity when not many people were willing to, and saw that I still had talent and I still had value and was able to contribute. So I would very much encourage anyone to check out AML Wrestling. It's also the company that puts on the big WrestleCade convention every Thanksgiving weekend. You can follow that at WrestleCade or WrestleCade.com. That's a huge, huge, huge event. You've been down there at least once that I know of. Same, you know, people behind both. But yeah, AML every month in and around North Carolina. You can hear me behind the microphone again. And Grant is all over the hardwood and the football fields and the volleyball courts all over the Atlantic Coast Conference now.
Yeah, like I haven't shot or edited a wrestling show since SCI 2018, so I have less wrestling-centric stuff to plug, and I don't think the ACC Network needs me to plug them. So
you know, I don't get the ACC Network, actually.
I don't either. I just work there.
I got ATT Uverse, and they won't give it to me. I can't get it.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I actually think a lot of the people that run AML, as well as, you know, Matt Griffin down in Action in Georgia, obviously, you know, everybody at SCI are just all wonderful people.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for that. Big shout out to Matt Griffin, who was the first person to say, hey, come call my show, please. And if it wasn't 6 hours away on a weekday, I would love to be a bigger part of Action. But I'm glad you mentioned him, because he was, if I remember correctly, and I think I do, he was the first person that said, hey, please come and be a part of this thing. So thank you, Matt Griffin.
Yeah. I mean, at StatMark, StatMark.
Cool. Gentlemen, thank you. I know it's been a... emotional. I appreciate it very, very much. I think this needed to be discussed, and I really appreciate you guys giving your expert opinions here. And
Hey, let us thank you, Ben, because I mean, this kind of has been 2 years in the making, and if nothing else, I mean, maybe you've given us our own bit of closure on the whole thing by finally getting, you know, this out there.
No, thank you. You guys did the work here. I appreciate it very, very much. But you guys did the work here, and. It was about that time, especially with what went on about a month or so ago, or a couple weeks ago. So, thank you, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure and an honor. I hope to see you soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you, man.
Thanks, guys.
On the Place to Be Nation pop feed, the Sarcastic Four are back with the latest episode of Marvel Age Podcast, where they continue to look at roughly one-third of the most significant of Marvel's output for the year 1972. On Looking Forward, Looking Back Sports, Cowboy and John D'Amato look back at the recent MLB season and ahead to the newest NBA season. The hard-traveling fanboys go off the page and look at the 1974 television movie Wonder Woman. DC4U continues Green Lantern Month by taking a deep dive into the Four Horsemen. This week in the NFL hits weekly as well, with Roger and Johnny recapping the last set of games and previewing the upcoming weekend batch. Kevin and Mary host the Brother Sister Rewatch podcast with The Office Season 3, Episodes 22 and 23. On Diamond Conversations, the fifth episode features a one-on-one chat with J. David Herman, who wrote the book Almost Yankees, The Summer of 81, the greatest baseball team you never heard of, which is about the 81 Columbus Clippers. In the PTBM Pop Special, Andy Atherton, Todd Weber, and Scott Criscolo break down the brackets and matchups for the greatest sitcom of all time tournament. In another PTBM Pop Special, Jason Sherman, Andy Atherton, and Miranda Berthold break down the launch of Disney Plus. The greatest sitcom of all time tournament kicks off Monday, November 25th, beginning with the play-in round. There will be four matchups per day, so be sure to like the tournament page so you won't miss a single one. On the wrestling feed, Body Press Your Luck started up. It's our first wrestling trivia game show, with JT Rosero and Jordan Duncan welcoming Ryan Everett, Neil Trauma, and Logan Crossland. If you think you have what it takes to be on the show, reach out to us and we can try to get you on a future show. The latest edition of Place to Be Podcast, JT and Scott are joined by Jennifer Smith to review the February 1990 MSG House Show. On part two of the main event, on number 137, Nate Scott and Steve go back to 2002 to check out the 20th TNA pay-per-view. On Wrestling Warzone, JT and Chad dive into Raw Nitro from 2596. Jenny and the Gems look at the 1988 Greensboro WWE Hidden Gem. And our newest show is called With This Ring. Husband and wife Ryan and Cindy look at five matches and discuss where they are on their WWE match list. On Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, John, and Jenny look at their ECW adventure with Hostile City Showdown. We got a new feed called The Jenny Positions. They're home of geek and sassy, talk and pop, freak out driving, and telling stories. Go to placetobenation.com every day if you can. We get fresh voices and fresh takes, including SmackDown and Fox Report, This Week in WWE, Paulie's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, and Ben's Unpopular Opinion. We also got columns like Glenn's Weekly Walk and Scott and Logan's Campus Hot Takes, looking back at the biggest college football matchups. If you're doing online shopping, go to placetobenation.com/Amazon. It'll take you right to Amazon and helps us out with no cost to you. Check out our social media pages and message board at bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in the conversation today and start researching your list. Ballots are now open, and the ballot link is available on the Facebook group page.